This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. 11 years before Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat to a white person on a city bus in Montgomery, Alabama, Irene Morgan committed a similar act of defiance on a Greyhound bus in Virginia. Morgan was arrested on site and convicted of violating segregation laws. But she appealed her conviction all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1946, her case resulted in a landmark ruling that declared segregated travel on interstate buses unconstitutional. But southern states, including North Carolina, shrugged off the court's decision, so blacks who tried to ride in the era of Jim Crow continued to be punished and humiliated. The next year, 16 men, 8 white and 8 black, decided to stage an elaborate protest. They rode through the South together, frequently getting arrested during a 2-week trip that they called the Journey of Reconciliation. That protest would later inspire the Freedom Rides of the 1960s, which boasted more than 400 participants. Tonight, historian Derek Katzum will give a talk about the legacy of the Journey of Reconciliation. He's going to be at the Wilson Special Collections Library on the campus of UNC Chapel Hill. Derek is author of Freedom's Main Line, Journey of Reconciliation and the Freedom Rides, and I'm pleased to welcome him to the program right now. Thanks for joining us, Derek.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Let's start with the Supreme Court case that inspired the Journey of Reconciliation. What are the important details of that decision?
Irene Morgan was traveling between Virginia and Maryland via Washington, D.C., and she was recovering from a sickness, a medical problem, and she sat in the front of a bus and just didn't want to get up, ended up being arrested based on violating Virginia's Jim Crow statutes. And as a result, the case sort of accelerated, and the NAACP thought it was a good test case, and they carried it through to the Supreme Court. And the issue became that she was engaging in interstate transportation, which is to say traveling between two states, and therefore the only body capable of regulating interstate commerce is the Congress. And so the Supreme Court determined that the laws of Virginia were repugnant to the Commerce Clause, was the language that they used, and therefore they overturned her conviction and set the precedent on interstate conveyances.
And of course, her story sounds similar to that of Rosa Parks. We now know that Rosa was not quite the little old lady at the back of the bus. She'd received quite a bit of training and was ready for this. What about Irene?
She was it was much more of one of those circumstances of someone who had decided simply to mount a challenge at the time. But that was not uncommon. One of the things that I think people need to recognize is that the history of interstate transportation, the history of local transportation as well, was characterized by individuals just saying enough. And some of them ended up becoming invisible. Some of those people ended up getting arrested. Nothing happened. Some of them, it wasn't worth it for the state to prosecute or pursue it. And some of them, a handful of them, became court cases. And Irene Morgan was one of those cases.
So the court had spoken. Southern states defied the court ruling, ignored the ruling, and went ahead. What was the federal response to their defiance?
It would vary. The reality was that it depended on the strength of any given case. With the Morgan versus Virginia decision, in many incidents, the judges and lawyers literally had not heard of it. They didn't know about it. So they'd go into court and one of the lawyers would say, well, there's this case. And in one or two examples, the members of the Journey of Reconciliation actually had to give their copy to the judge to see it. And then that oftentimes, though not always, resulted in the cases being dismissed.
Now, how did the Journey of Reconciliation come together?
An organization called the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is a World War I era pacifist organization, and the Congress of Racial Equality, which was newly emerged during the World War II era, decided that they wanted to test, one, whether there was adherence to Morgan versus Virginia, and two, whether people were aware of it. And so it was partially to challenge whether or not it was being adhered to, and partially as a form of education for people. And they made the plans to travel. And they sort of recognized that traveling into the maw of the Deep South might not be the best of ideas. And as we saw with the Freedom Rides, you know, a while later, that proved to be fairly accurate. And so they made plans to travel from Washington through Virginia to North Carolina, across the mountains to Tennessee, up and then back across Virginia and into Washington.
Well, and of course, the Freedom Rides did take place in the context of a civil rights movement which had already received headlines. this was going to be the vanguard. They were going to travel into the South without any cover, without any sense that they were that there was a movement underway.
Yeah, I mean, they were in many ways part of a very small movement that wasn't known as the movement at the time. Mm-hmm. And this is an example of how the civil rights movement doesn't somehow emerge out of nowhere in 1954, and then suddenly Brown versus Board, and people are like, oh, maybe we should challenge this. In fact, they had been challenging it, but this is under the operation of much more episodic attempts to sort of fight Jim Crow.
Interesting, too, the involvement of this group called the Fellowship of Reconciliation, because this was, as you said, a pacifist group that grew out of World War One, not necessarily a civil rights group, and it begins to come together, and they will be part of the foundation of what becomes a nonviolent struggle later.
Oh, absolutely, both with the ties to religion and the belief in a particular view of Christianity, as well as the fact that a number of the members of Fellowship of Reconciliation in particular had been conscientious objectors in World War II, and a handful of them would continue on with the movement as it progressed down the road. So there are these real linkages between pacifist movements and anti-war movements and other social justice movements and what would come to be known as the civil rights movement.
Now, where was the NAACP in all this?
The NAACP would end up throughout not only this but also the Freedom Rides being a bit of a reluctant partner. The NAACP, for one thing, always would prefer to be able to control situations. But furthermore, whenever they were looking for a challenge through their legal defense fund, they wanted cases that were going to win, because a loss could also set a precedent, and a loss would also etch in stone, because of stare decisis, certain elements of whatever happened in a case. So they were very reluctant and very gun-shy. And so when it came to, there was a group arrested in Chapel Hill, and they were the one group out of a number of arrests on the Journey of Reconciliation in North Carolina, where all the arrests happened. There was one group in Chapel Hill that was arrested, and they wanted to pursue the case to the Supreme Court. And the NAACP said, well, the problem is that while you bought all your tickets in Washington, D.C., and therefore believe, and we believe, you are interstate passengers, the particular leg of the trip you were traveling was from Durham to Chapel Hill, and the two courts below you both said that they saw it as intrastate, and we can't see the delineation, we can't guarantee it, and we want to make sure that we have the right case for this to happen.
Well, just as an aside, it sounds like there was better bus service and mass transit then than there is now. But that's for another program. But let's talk about that Chapel Hill case and why they thought that one would be so good.
Well, part of it, of course, is the history of Chapel Hill itself, which was seen as this bastion of progressivism in a state that itself had a reputation for moderation relative to the rest of the South. I think they thought that they had a good chance because they had bought their tickets in Washington, D.C. in a sort of consistent, almost like a triptych sort of thing, where it's a long ticket that you hand portions out to. They felt like they had seen a number of the other cases dismissed in North Carolina, in Durham and Raleigh, and later in Asheville, and in Greensboro as well, I believe. And so they felt like they had a reasonably good shot. But for whatever reason, the authorities in Chapel Hill decided to pursue the case rather than drop the charges. And as a consequence, and of course, it's interesting in Chapel Hill because for all of the I think in many ways very real sense of progressivism there, the only violence on the Journey of Reconciliation actually happened in Chapel Hill, where despite the fact that the university lent a real an air of moderation, a real air of, in some cases, liberalism, despite the presence of the longtime president of the university, Frank Porter Graham, who was a real legendary figure when it came to questions of human rights and justice, that didn't necessarily translate to I'm a college professor, and I'd love to think that my views sort of represent the whole of any community that I'm in. But that's not always the case. And when the Journey of Reconciliation arrived, there was not only a little bit of violence, but also very much threats of violence throughout their time in Chapel Hill.
What form did that take?
A number, for whatever reason, taxi cab drivers tended to really be aggressive on these issues. And one taxi cab driver, when a group of them gathered, punched Jim Peck in the face. And then a number of them gathered and they followed a group. There was a minister, a Presbyterian minister in Chapel Hill named Charles Jones. And he was very much known for his sort of humanitarian view of rights. And he was ferrying some of the groups to his home to protect them. And they were followed and they gathered at his home. And only the intervention of one taxi driver said, you know what, let's not. do this prevented him. And even after that, he actually had to leave town for a while. Reverend Jones did. And he received threats and everything. So it was very much a situation where there was progressivism, but it doesn't mean everyone was progressive.
And we actually have a clip of tape from that Presbyterian minister, Charles Jones, talking about the environment in Chapel Hill at the time.
In the 40s, we got along famously what I call a permissive period here in the university. You could do anything so long as it wasn't made public. I didn't make fuss. And now, when it comes to something like the 47 thing, which was almost sure to bring some kind of conflict.
All right, so there you are, Charles Jones, talking about the paradox, really, the sort of dual vision of Chapel Hill. You also mentioned James Peck. Now, he was a young man on this journey. He would gain fame on the Freedom Rides in the 1960s as one who was brutally beaten in Alabama.
Yeah, he's a remarkable figure. He had been challenging the system from pretty much the get-go. He showed up at a Harvard dance when he was a student there with a black co-ed, and that raised some eyebrows. And he was a conscientious objector who served prison time as a result of not serving in World War II in any capacity. He was central to both this Fellowship of Reconciliation movement as well as to the establishment of the Congress of Racial Equality. And he would be the only person to participate on both the Journey of Reconciliation and the Freedom Ride. So he's a really remarkable figure who provides a sort of connecting rod between these pre- and post-Brown periods of ongoing civil rights activism.
Another connection might be Bayard Rustin, who was also part of the Journey of Reconciliation or involved somehow.
Oh, absolutely. He's not only is he a central figure, but he's one of the four who's arrested in Chapel Hill, and he's one of three who ends up serving 22 days on a chain gang in North Carolina, and a remarkable figure when it comes to civil rights sort of written broadly.
Well, and not only for his active participation, but also a singer and a songwriter, and he contributed this particular song to the civil rights movement.
You don't have to ride Jim Crow. No, you don't have to ride Jim Crow. On June the 3rd, the High Court said, when you ride in the state, Jim Crow is dead. You don't have to ride Jim Crow. And when you get on the
Bayard Rustin, of course, who would go on to be a key figure in the civil rights movement later on. And you talked about him being on the chain gang. There was an interesting judgment about those who participated in the Journey of Reconciliation when they got to Chapel Hill.
Sure. Early on, when the initial court decision happens, the black, the two of the four who were black were given $25 fines. And the two who are white were given the full prison sentences. And an indication in many ways, which you see throughout the movement, of a sense of almost betrayal on the part of those whites who participated, and that the blacks may not have had that much agency. They were sort of stirred up. And in fact, I won't use the exact quotation, but they were accused of coming down to stir up the black population. And as a consequence of that, of course, it is indicative there was supposed to be a sense of white unity on these issues. A later court did make them all get the same sentence. And three of the four served it, and one basically stayed up in Cincinnati, a law student, and said, no, I don't think I'm going to come down.
That was a common sentiment among whites in the South at the time, that this wouldn't be a problem if it wasn't for you outside agitators. Was it a common sentence? Did that happen where whites would be sentenced more harshly than blacks in other Southern states?
It could go both ways. When it came to civil rights activism, that might occasionally happen. But oftentimes, of course, in places like Parchment Farm in Mississippi, where they had prison gangs and everything, that minor crimes could bring about larger sentences. So it would really vary. But sometimes with civil rights activism, it would be the case. And of course, when it came to violence, as you see on the Freedom Ride, sometimes the white activists really bear the brunt of it. And that's obviously a indication of some of the complexities of race relations.
Well, you talked about the fact that two people were arrested and charged, and yet 16 were on the bus. And we have one of the participants in the rides, Igor Rudenko. And this is recorded in an interview in 1974, where he talks about the way the rides were structured.
So we planned very carefully this journey of reconciliation, which was the last 2 weeks, and we got interstate tickets. Starting from Washington down through Richmond and and into North Carolina, across North Carolina to Kentucky and Tennessee, and then back through Virginia to Washington. We broke up into two groups, one group going Trailways, the other going Greyhound. We would stop each night in another town, generally have a public meeting at a college or a black church, and then proceeding the next day. And each day we would decide on two guinea pigs. I mean, a black and a white would sit together in the front, or two whites would sit in the back, or two blacks would sit in the front, or, and the others on the trip, and there were about 20 to 25 of us, the others in the bus would act as observers, so that if and when these cases came to court, they could act as witnesses.
That's Igor Rudenko, who is from New York, one of the participants on the Journey of Reconciliation. That tape, by the way, a number of interviews housed at the Wilson Special Collections Library at UNC. And my guest, Derek Katzum, is the author of Freedom's Mainline, and he's going to be speaking at the Wilson Library today at 5 o'clock. But first, let me ask you some more about the coverage of this event at the time. What kind of coverage was it getting locally and nationally?
Modest, very modest. The local newspapers would cover it and would pick up on it, and it was a fleeting issue. So it didn't get national attention. It didn't become an issue. They didn't become a cause celeb. It was like so many civil rights challenges at the time. It happened. It was local, stirred up folks a little bit, and then kind of disappears into the transom of history.
This was in the late 40s. The Freedom Rides take place in the early 60s. Was there a discussion about repeating this? What happened and why didn't it become part of the arsenal earlier?
Throughout the late 1940s and 1950s, the Congress of Racial Equality had wanted to do what they called another Journey of Reconciliation. And every so often, something would crop up and they'd say, well, maybe we should try it. But they never quite had the institutional foundation. They never quite had the justification. They didn't have a similar case. It just didn't happen. And then suddenly 1960, you have a court case, Boynton versus Virginia, that establishes that not only the buses that serve interstate passengers, but the facilities on the ground, the bus terminals, the bus stations, the restaurants, and so forth, also were engaged in interstate commerce. And as a consequence, that they also could not be segregated. And so that sort of caused the impetus and said, hey, let's have another Journey of Reconciliation. And at one point when they're in the planning, they're deciding, well, are we going to call it another Journey of Reconciliation? What are we going to call it? And someone said, well, what we're doing really is we'd be riding for freedom, right? And so they called it Freedom Ride 1961. And interestingly enough, they wrote a song for that as well, which showed the role of music in the movement.
All the way through. And in fact, a young singer-songwriter by the name of Bernice Regan would be part of that movement, and she later went on to form Sweet Honey in the Rock.
Absolutely.
And so a lot of people came out of that movement and those rides. Were there references made to the Journey of Reconciliation as they were organizing the Freedom Rides?
Yes. The Congress of Racial Equality was very cognizant of their own history, and with Jim Peck participating and James Farmer, who'd been a member of CORE in the 1940s but had not participated in the Journey of Reconciliation, you had some institutional memory. So you had a sense among the participants of the Journey of Reconciliation being important. But they didn't really necessarily convey that when they sent letters out to before they went out and when they dealt with whatever media they dealt with.
Derek, pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Derek Katzum is the author of Freedom's Mainline, The Journey of Reconciliation and the Freedom Rides, also an associate professor of history at the University of Texas at Permian Basin.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, welcome to North Carolina. Tonight, Derek speaks about the Journey of Reconciliation at the Wilson Library on the campus of UNC Chapel Hill. Starts at 5 o'clock, free and open to the public. More information, visit lib.unc.edu. Also, a play about the Freedom Rides called The Parchment Hour begins its run tonight at Playmakers in Chapel Hill, playmakersrep.org. Coming up, the story writer invents an unlikely environmental activist for her debut novel. Stay tuned.
Go quiet like if you face arrest. NAACP will make a test. You don't have to ride Jim Crow. And someday we'll all be free. Yes, someday we'll all be free. When united action turns the tide and black and white sit side by side. Oh, someday we'll all be free.